Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Chatting with Sharing. Today I am really excited. We're going to have Chris Lemon, and he's going to talk about his one-man show, which is based on his book, A Twist of Lemon. He's going to talk about also not only the book, but an independent film he's doing. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you so much for having me, Sherry.
I'm so excited. I mean, you're one of my favorites. I've seen almost everything you've ever done, so I'm so happy to have you on the show.
Well, that's a great way to start an interview.
It's the truth.
No, it's great to be here.
For those who don't know about your background, you're Jack Lemmon's son, and you're an actor in your own right, and you're very talented, but can you give a little bit more to the audience so they know a little bit more about you?
Well, sure. It's interesting, you know, because a lot of the younger generation doesn't even know who Jack Lemmon is anymore. And so that's one of the reasons that one of the side reasons that I'm having so much fun doing this show, because we do get a lot of young people in the audience. And afterwards, they're the first ones I beeline to and say, well, what'd you think? And they said, well, you know, I didn't really know who those people were that you were talking about, because there's like 60 or 70 other characters from that wonderful generation of the golden age of Hollywood. But I love the story, because it's about a father and a son, and it's a very universal story for that aspect. But my father was one of the world's most beloved actors, as I say in the beginning of the show. He did films like Some Like It Hot, which was America Film Institute's judged the number one comedy of all time. And then on the other side of the coin, he did things like Glengarry Glen Ross, which is the film that personally I've been asked about most when the subject comes up. And then he did, the wonderful Grumpy Old Men films. And a lot of young people do know those films. They'll say, well, I don't know who Jack Lemmon is, but Walter Matthau is. I say, have you ever seen Grumpy Old Men? They say, yeah, it's my favorite film.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah, it's always that kind of, it's a very interesting dichotomy. And I always get a kick out of it, as I'm sure Pop would as well. You know, it is what it is. Times change, and so do our heroes, and especially those heroes of the silver screen. I played older houses as well, and during the course of the show, for reasons that had to do with the narrative of the show, I mentioned the great silent film star, Harold Lloyd. And a lot of these people of my generation, which we won't talk about how old that is, and older, don't know who Harold Lloyd is. And he was one of the
I
Ian
do.
Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin. Well, there you go. Good for you, Sherry. They don't know that. So things change, and that's just the way of the world. And there's nothing wrong with that. But it really is kind of fun to be able to get up for 90 minutes every evening and remind people of that wonderful age of innocence when I lived on Santa Monica Beach back in the late 60s and early 70s, back when it was, the Pacific Coast Highway was meant to cruise down in convertibles, not get from point A to point B as quickly as humanly possible. As a kid in fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, I used to hop on my Stingray bike and actually ride up the Pacific Coast Highway and the Pacific Coast ramp up to a little school up in Santa Monica Heights, which is what we called it back in those days.
Tried
putting an 11-year-old kid on a bicycle riding up the Pacific Coast Highway these days. It's not a smart idea. So,
anyways,
there's a typically long Lemon answer to your question. We tend to do about a half hour on Lemon. So,
well, I actually know some. Well, he's no longer with us, but know someone who worked with your dad. His name was Johnny Seven. He did The Apartment. Do you remember him? Yeah, he was the one who played Shirley MacLaine's brother who punched your dad.
Oh, sure. Oh, he was scary as heck in that. Yeah. He was very good in that. Yeah, he was terrific with his black leather caddy outfit.
Yeah. Yeah, he told us this cute story. He said, we did the thing about five times. It was letter perfect. Everything was great, but the adrenaline was running and everything. And one time, your dad moved a little bit wrong, and he was full of energy, and he actually accidentally clipped him.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That's the take that Billy used.
Well, I bet it was. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, as they say, in different vernacular, stuff happens, especially when you're doing stunts, you know, on stage and on set. I did a TV series with my dear friend Hulk Hogan a little while back called Thunder in Paradise, and we did a number of our own stunts. And I can't tell you how many times I got clipped. It's part of the. It's part of the game, and actually the only reason I go on about it is because there's a very cute story about in the show that I tell about when we do the Walter Matthau section. Of course, there has to be a sizable Walter Matthau section. He was my father's very favorite. He was my father's best friend and favorite actor, acting partner. They did, I think it's 10 films together. Yes, they did 10 films together.
Wow.
And on one of them, they were doing a stunt, and Walter took a fall and, you know, and was knocked unconscious.
Oh, I know that story.
Yeah. You know this story?
No,
yeah.
Go on,
and my
tell
father
the
rushes
story
over
for the
to
audience.
Him, lifts his
great.
Head up. Yeah, yeah. My father rushes over to him, takes off his jacket, folds it up, lifts his head up, slips it underneath, and as Walter's eyes started to flutter open, he asks him, Waltz, are you comfortable? Waltz looks up at him and says, I make a living.
So, I remember. They told that story on themselves.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Well, most of the stories, it's interesting how this all started. And I know this is one of the questions that you're going to ask me, so we might as well jump into it since that's a good segue.
Okay.
The whole thing started with a search for catharsis on my part after my father left me. I adored him. He was truly not just my father. He was truly my very best friend. And so I started writing down our memories in an attempt to sort of heal that wounded area inside of me. You know, you never know how much you love somebody until they're gone. Even if you think you do, you don't. And, you know, same thing when my mother left me. You know, it was just a huge hole in my psyche. And so I started writing down memories. And the next thing I knew, I wasn't just writing down memories. I was writing a story about a father and a son, and one that actually had a real story to it. It was very unique, obviously. His guy was Jack Lemmon, but universal. He could have been a coal miner, and it still would have been that story. And the book did well, and it turned into a book tour, and a lot of people were deeply touched by the message of the book. And I thought, you know, maybe I can take this a step further. And I turned it into sort of a performance piece, and, you know, tried different stuff with it. These things take forever. See, I mean, you know, to create a one-man play is an enormously complex process, and it really is that most perilous form of theater. So it has to be right if you're going to stand out there by yourself in front of people for 90 minutes. And finally, you know, it sort of, you know, occurred to me that, well, it's got to be done in his voice. It can't be a piece of theater unless it's, you know, it can't be me telling the story. It's got to be him. And that's when it became a piece of theater. And to sort of summarize why I'm prattling on like this, my father once said to me, if you can touch just one person, you've done your job. And recently, when it was still in its experimental phases and we were messing around with it, I was doing a run at the Royal George Theater in Chicago. And one of the critics, one of the reviewers — we've had wonderful reviews so far, thank the Lord — one of the reviewers came up to me and he said, you know, with tears in his eyes. I go, oh boy. He says, I have an estranged relationship with my father. And because of your show, I'm going to go down to Florida. I'm going to go down to Orlando, Florida, and I'm going to attempt to patch things back together and see if we can't make things work. And, you know, right then and there, I just thought, oh my God, if my humble message, you know, moved this one person enough, then I'm kind of fulfilling my father's, you know, mandate. If you can touch just one person, you've done your job. Well, to finish that story up, I just was recently down. I've been in Florida a few times. I just got back from Florida last weekend. Wonderful time at Villages in Florida. What a place that is. Wow. But before that, I did a run in Mount Dora, Florida. who thought Mount Dora? Who, you know, it's who knew there was a mount anywhere in Florida? But as you know, we did it, and it was a lovely, lovely evening. Boy, the Florida audiences are just terrific. They love this show, and everybody's having fun. So I decided to go out and say hi to everybody afterwards, and I'm talking to him in the lobby, and I look over, there's the guy from Chicago. With tears in his eyes, he comes up to me. He goes, I have to tell you, I came down to Florida after the, I told you that, up in Chicago. I got together with my father. We requited our relationship, and I decided to move down here and work from here instead, and now we're the best of friends.
Aww.
And I thought, oh, my goodness. You know, if my humble message can do that, if nothing else ever happens with this, at least that did. And that... that just sort of it just sort of validates all the, it's been a decade. I've been working on this show for a decade to make it come to this place, and that validates it all the work, all the, you know, all the hours and the work and the stuff. And so yeah, it was a wonderful story, and that's kind of, you know, for me at this point, it's as an artist to be able at this point in my life and my career to, you know, I've done some good work that I've worked that I'm proud of and work that I'm very happy with, but I never had a magnum opus. You know, I never did that thing that if they stick me in a pine box tomorrow, I can point at it and say I did that. As an artist, as a father and a husband, that's a whole different story. I've got three incredible kids and a beautiful wife of 28 years. I'm happy to say, but as an artist, you know, to be able to do that has been an enormous, and to bring together my music, my writing, my acting, all of it, into this show. But also personally, to be able to deliver this honest message that has touched people, it's just been a wonderful ride so far. And I'm having a ball, and I'm hoping it goes on for a while.
I think that's amazing. I know how you feel. I lost my dad.
It's a hell of a
dad.
Story, isn't it?
Yeah, I lost my dad several years ago, and I write, and he pops into my writing all the time. It's it's like it's an expression. So you're talking to them because they're not here. And I think that's it's the best I can do for explaining.
Well, absolutely.
So you touched me just explaining it.
And it's cathartic for you, isn't it?
Yeah, very, very. Because I miss
it.
My,
it really
I'm a
is.
Daddy's
and
girl.
When, yeah, listen, my wife just lost her dad just a few months ago, and you know, it was really tough on her. He was such a great guy, and. He lived right here. We live in Connecticut. We moved here because she's from here, and because of him and his wife, her mother and the family and all that stuff. And it was really, really tough on her. And, you know, and so every once in a while, and she knows what the situation is with me in the book. So every once in a while, I'll see her over in the corner scribbling away, and I know what's going on. You know, she's hurting, and she looks to those memories because, you know, except for that horrendous disease of Alzheimer's, which is just a curse, you know, and hopefully we're going to do something soon. Except for that, the one thing you can really take with you, you can't take the Porsches and the condos, but, you know, or the jewelry, but you can take the love and you can take the memories. That you can take with you. And that is the most eternal gift we human beings have been bequeathed. And so, you know, that's what I say to people when they come up to me after these shows and say how much my message has moved them. I said, you know, go to those people you love and tell them you love them and hug them as hard as you can, because you don't know what you got until it's gone.
Yep, so true. Your dad took a lot of risks, too. I mean, he did things like the China Syndrome. He did television shows that people thought were kind of risky. And do you feel that the show is like that kind of a risk, like your dad doing that kind of stuff?
Absolutely, and I'm constantly looking to make it even deeper. As a matter of fact, I'm meeting with a wonderful group of producers, Broadway producers, because, of course, we want that's where our sights are set. I don't know about Broadway. That's really kind of almost all musicals now, you know, but just off Broadway, I think it would be just wonderful. And I think this show will really resonate there. I literally just went down and did a private showing for them night before last. That's why I sound like I've been hit by a truck. I didn't get home until about 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, after being on the road for the last 9 months. But hey, you know what? Welcome to the stage. There's nothing like it, boy. I'll tell you. I don't know how much time we have, but I got plenty of stories for you too about just how
over
40 crazy.
Minutes,
you know,
so you're good.
Fabulous. It's you know, stage is crazy to begin with, one man stage show, one person performance is sort of the high wire act of live entertainment. It's that most perilous form of theater. But anyway, what the hell was I talking about? That's not something else we lemons do aside
about the risk.
Yeah, we go off on tangents. But yeah, I'm always looking to find deeper. You know, there's no wire coat hangers in this story. He wasn't that kind of a guy, and neither was I. But as a narrator, it's my duty to expose the entire story, which includes all the bumps in the road as well, on both our parts. We're all human beings. We're all fallible. We all have fallacies. And we all have our little, hello operators, as my father used to say, hello operator, we got a bad connection. I have our little dugouts that we do in life so we don't have to face, hurt and difficulty. But the fact is life is filled with that kind of stuff. So yes, there's no wire coat hangers in this story. This is a story about a very dignified and gallant man and his pretty dignified and gallant son too, if I may be so bold as to say. But it is a deeply tragic story at its core. It's a story about a father and a son who, for a number of different reasons, are ripped apart, literally, and cast asunder and spent many, many years away from each other. But then through a conscious effort on both our parts, we decide to come back together and end up becoming the best of friends against all odds. And, of course, he dies at the age of 76. And he's taken away from me again. So at its core, it really is a very tragic and universal story. But the difference is it's couched in the lore of the golden age of Hollywood, when Hollywood was Camelot, those incredible years with these incredible people surrounding it. 60. I do the whole thing in the voice of my father. I come out as me. I give my little mission statement. Then I become him in front of the audience, and I do the entire show as him. Then I return to being me for just two or three sentences at the end to capsulize, be very important. It was very necessary to find out what it means to Chris. Of course, it's a father-son story. But as I'm doing him, as I'm channeling him, I should say, because that's what I have to do in order to make it work, I do 60, 70, I think even more than that, other characters from that incredible age. Everything from, you know, Walter Matthau to Jimmy Cagney to Marilyn Monroe. And the crazy thing is, it's not me doing it, it's Pop, which is kind of a trip as an actor and fun. But this whole ramble is about the fact that, yes, it's all about taking risks. It's all about telling the story honestly. I discuss in depth his alcoholism, but I do it in such a way because it was so gallant at that time, the way that he went ahead and not only attacked it personally, and he did, and I stand testament to that, and handled it and never had a drink after he made the decision, but also did it publicly during a time when it was not by any means in vogue. It could have been tantamount to career suicide. He did it right there on the actor's studio, right in front of James Lipton. And you can see by Lipton's reaction, this was not a scheduled discussion or a rehearsed discussion. It was out of the blue. My father just went, "I'm an alcoholic."
That.
Yeah.
I remember that show.
And he did it right there, did it in front of the world. And and I asked him afterwards, I said, "Why'd you do that? I really admire you for doing it, but why?" And he said, "Because if I can help just one person, I've done my job." And that was always one of his big credos. And, you know, so it is handled in exactly that manner throughout the show, within the show. And the fact that he did place his career in front of his family, he admitted it, and he admitted it to me. And it was the way it was. Career always came first for a number of different reasons. And these are very powerful themes. And you know, as a matter of fact, I was talking to the Broadway producers after I gave them their run through, and they just said, you know, there's about a dozen times throughout this show where I feel like somebody hit me across the head with a baseball bat. And, you know, that's what has to happen in this type of theater. It has to be astounding. But at the same time, it has to be wonderfully entertaining. And, you know, there's times when, I mean, oh, the laughs in this show, it's so wonderful as an entertainer to sit there and literally go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and count to 20, and they're still laughing. You know, and silences, big silences too, which I love just as much as the last. My illegitimate brother Kevin Spacey, who he really is my illegitimate brother, who wrote the foreword to the book, as you know, he's who I adore. But he was the one who said that I came to see him in Richard III. And I, you know, he was brilliant, of course. And they said, you got some big laughs. And he says, yeah, I got some big silences, too. And I said, I know exactly what you're talking about, because that is such a turn on when you sit there and you can just hear a pin drop. There's a moment where I talk, we did Missing about Charles Horman and Ed Horman. Charles Horman was murdered, of course, for uncovering American complicity in the Chilean coup in 1973. Right. And I turn to the audience after I've told that story. I turn to the audience and I say, how does a parent deal with that, with the loss of a child? How does a father deal with the loss of his son? And this show is delivered directly to the audience. I don't play this show out. I want it to be like you're sitting in, across a table from Jack Lemmon having a cup of coffee and he's telling you his story. So I make direct eye contact with the audience pretty much 90% of the show. And, of course, at that moment, I do as well. I turn to some poor, unfortunate man in the front row and say, how does a father deal with the loss of his son? And there's just about a 10-second beat after that, that silence. It's just, it's like fuel for a performer, you know. So the laughs. One of the other sub themes, I ramble, you know, I'm sorry, folks, this is what you get when you ask 11 on the air. One of the sub themes in it also is the fact that my father never understood why comedy and drama had to be delineated, especially in his era of performance. Actors were pigeonholed. They were comedic actors, or they were this kind of actor or that kind of actor, you know. Really rallied against that, because his great hero was Jean-Louis Barrault, who was the French mime director who did probably the most famous French film ever made, Les Enfants de Paradis, The Children of Paradise. He had that ability to make you laugh and make you cry at the same time. And that's the key theme, not narrative theme, but theme of the show, his personal theme. Is his quest to find that one project where he could make you laugh and make you cry at the same time. And, of course, he finally did in The Apartment. So When people ask me, what is your favorite film of your father's, I have to say The Apartment for that very reason. And that is an enormous theme throughout the play as well. So it was very necessary for me as a writer to construct the play in order to reflect that. I try to have you, and this is tying back to the beats that I just told you about, I try to have you have this moment of utter silence and tears, and then the next thing you know, I'm doing Walter Matthau, and you're laughing. So, you know, it's throughout the entire 90 minutes, that is a very strong thematic device.
Even when the early films he did, you felt the drama of what he did. That I can't remember the name of the movie. It was with Judy Holliday. It was the first one I think he did.
Or It Should Happen to You. It Should Happen to You.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And when he does that part where he's talking to her on the film, he breaks your heart. He does.
Yeah.
He's just, and it's like, it's a full comedy, but he's always had that ability to do drama and comedy.
It's just stupid for people
to pigeonhole him.
Yeah, it was with him from the start, and he literally says that, right? I do The Apartment after I give that statement. Look at Barrault. Here's a guy who could make you laugh and then break your hearts all at the same time. And that's when I could do that, that's when I knew I would be an actor. So when I finally teed up with my buddy Shirley MacLaine and Billy Wilder for a film called The Apartment, that's when I knew I was going to show folks what Jean-Louis Barrault was all about. And he does a scene from The Apartment. And then I come up and I literally, as Jack, I say, you know, I was pigeonholed. So I knew when I finally got the chance to show folks what I thought acting should be all about, that's when I could finally play those roles I only ever dreamed of, like Joe Clay in The Days of Wine and Roses. And then I fall back into the shadows and do a scene from The Days of Wine and Roses. So it has, and that all happens right after I finish doing the ending with my father and Joey Brown from Some Like It Hot. Well, nobody's perfect.
Oh, I love that movie.
So you see, it's look at the logo for acting. It's a smiley face and a sad face. That's what it's supposed to be. That's what it's been from the very start, you know. And so that was a very important thematic device to be able to find that. You're talking about his range being exhibited. His very first Academy Award in one of his very first films was from Mr. Roberts.
Mr. Roberts.
Where he plays this wonderful, zany, wacky guy who breaks your heart in the end when he reads
and
the letter
Holder.
That says Mr. Roberts has been killed.
You see that transformation on his face from boy to man within seconds. I mean, it was like most brilliant. That's why he probably got the Oscar, because just that part at the end.
That's what he did, you see. And aside from all the other stuff, it was important for me to reflect that as well. You had to dig down deep and find Jack the actor, Jack the entertainer, and what it was about him that made him so incredible. And that's exactly what we've been talking about for the last 10 minutes or so, and exactly what you just enumerated, Sherry. But it was also important for me to bring to this Jack Lemmon, the person, and that side of Jack Lemmon that only I knew and that only I saw, which was really what was the book was about, and to draw from the book and bring all of that as well about what a human leprechaun this guy was. He was just a hoot to be with. He was so much fun and full of beans, and I am able to weave in a lot of that story as well. That aspect that originally started the book, which I wrote because I wanted my children to be able to know him like I knew him, because he died so young. That's a wonderful part of it as well, because I can, you know, it's my duty not only to keep this golden age of Hollywood and this incredible artist alive, but also this wonderful guy and the memories of this wonderful guy, to keep that alive as well. And to be able to walk out there every night and share with people, you know, a side of Jack Lemmon that only I knew. So that's a real thrill as well.
It's like, he already gave us a legacy on the film, and you're giving us a secondary legacy of him, which is a really beautiful thing.
I really hope so, yes. That's what I'm shooting for, yeah.
That's so cool. What was it like? You worked on a few films with him, but what was it like the first time you actually worked with him in a film?
Scary as shit. I didn't work with him until That's Life, but I literally went down to visit him on the set of Airport 77. I was just out of Cal Arts. I didn't even have my SAG card yet. Gosh, how old? I'm maybe 23, something like that. I'd done a couple little things here and there, just, you know, little TV shows and this and that and the other thing, which is why I didn't become a classical pianist, because I started working as an actor and just never stopped. So the classical piano had to take a back seat until this show. Yay! I did a lot of piano and duet too. But anyway, so I show up to say hi in San Diego, as a matter of fact. You're based out of San Diego. And I show up to say hi on the set. And as it turns out, this one actor, little bit part, I don't know, for whatever reason, didn't show up that day. And all of a sudden, I see the director talking to my father on the corner. My father starts laughing his ass off. Pardon my language. And the director comes over to me and says, okay, here, go on, go see wardrobe. You're going to play this part. I go, what? And the next thing I know, there I am in front of, like, it was a huge crew. I mean, 300 people and this and that. And, you know, with lines like, "Captain, we have a beeper at longitude 97 degrees north, latitude 95.43, and the thing with the fuselage intact." And, you know, and I'm like, I'm looking at this stuff, and I was so damn nervous they had to write my lines out and paste them on the oscilloscope, which is like, that was old day radar back then. So they pasted my lines on the oscilloscope, and I just sat there staring at the oscilloscope. If you look very closely, you can see my eyes going back and forth, reading the lines. So that was the first time.
That one.
My old man back of the set, just, I mean, literally busting a nut. He was just back there, red faced, leaning over, you know, belly laughing the whole time I'm doing it. But I got it out. But really, ostensibly, the first time we worked, and only time we worked together, was on Bat's Life. It was a film that Blake Edwards, who was a dear friend and a wonderful, wonderful artist to the whole Lennon family. Matter of fact, he ended up selling me my first sports car. But anyway,
wow.
Bat's Life, which was a trip. I was shooting Duet at the time that we shot it, so I wasn't able to be there as much as I would like to. We wrote our own script, literally. The whole cast got together and outlined the script. Then went off and wrote our own parts, which of course meant that my father and I wrote ourselves 7-page monologues. And one of which stays in the film to this day. My whole scene is about a 4-page, 5-page monologue that I wrote myself. And that was just, it was just wonderful. I mean, what does that mean? Are we out of time? Hello? Hello, hello. Anybody there?
Chris?
Yes.
Hi, I'm sorry, my phone actually fell out.
Did it?
I am so sorry.
That's all right.
Sorry, audience. My phone just collapsed during the interview. I do apologize.
Not a problem.
Sorry, everybody. So I missed
we're on
whatever you were
hey.
Saying. Yes.
Well, I talk too much anyways, for God's sake. You can't get a word in edgewise when you're talking to me. And I've always tried to kind of cut that down, but forget about it. It's a very lemon trait. But anyways, it was just a hoot working with him, because not only is he such a consummate professional and, you know, and of course, obviously a brilliant actor, he's just such a mensch, you know, and he's so giving, you know, he's all those things you want to, you know, he's a great actor. It's so working with him was an absolute ball. And, you know, at least we got that one time that we could do that together. I would have loved to have done stage with him.
How many times, I know you didn't always work with him, but I know you did tribute. How many times did you actually were in a film with him?
That was it. That really, I mean, there was Dad, where both Gene and I was shooting Duet, and Gary David Goldberg, God bless his soul, was the executive producer on it, and he directed Pop in Dad. And he said, "Would you come?" There's these dream sequences where he dreams of himself and Olympia Dukakis as young. And Gina's got that kind of look, you know, where she could do Olympia. And so we went to a little farm just north of us where we live now, actually, in Duxbury, Mass., and did his dream sequences. I did Airport. He was in Airport. I did something else he was in. But really, the only time that we sat on camera together was Bat's Life.
I love that movie. It was a great movie. Well, I love Blake Edwards. I like anything he did.
Yeah, fabulous.
You are also a very talented musician. Your father showed you off on talk shows and stuff like that. I remember that. And I know he was also a talented musician. what did he, was he kind of disappointed that you didn't go into classical piano, or was he proud, or how did he feel
about
that?
No, I don't think
that?
There was any of that stuff going on. He was really not that kind of a guy. There was never discussion of the profession. Though the couple of times that he saw me in pieces that I was very proud of, I think one of which was Barefoot in the Park when I was quite young. I did with Jerry Paris directing, who's a brilliant director, wonderful artist. We did the California tour, 6 months actually on the road with Barefoot in the Park, and it was extremely successful. And he came to see it and was blown away. And I have a photograph of him caressing my cheek afterwards, looking up into my eyes and just saying, "Great job, kid." So that was a real life moment. Also, when I did Love Letters, yeah, it was because you know I have great, because I've also did a lot of shit. There was a few ripe ones, as they say, a couple of turkeys that he'd said to me. He said, "Well, you were pretty good. The material wasn't so great," and he that was about it. But that's all that he. When I did Love Letters with Steffi Zimbalist, so that too, we really hit it off. Steph and I, she remains a very dear friend to this day. And I remember the closing night he came to closing night, and we got a standing O. And I looked down into the front row, and there he was, and there were tears running down his cheek. So that was wonderful affirmation to have that come from him. But other than that, he really stayed in arm's length. He always had that about him. That's, I think, why he placed his career first. He was more comfortable in front of the camera or on stage than any place else, because he had a fear of being hurt, of extending himself too much emotionally. And real life kind of put him off a little bit. And he also had that whole fear of being sort of the stentorian father. "You shall do it this way, you know."
Yeah.
And "you will come, and I am very proud of you." He didn't want to be that. So it was always, you know, "I got a lot of hello, operator. We got a bad connection. Now let's go play golf." You know, that's the way he wanted, and that was fine by me. That's okay, because he was a father to me in so many other ways. He didn't need to be that kind of a father. And that was what I needed to come to terms with and chose to come to terms with. And that's what this play is all about. I chose not to have wire coat hangers in my life. I chose not to be, I don't have any patience for a Starz kid who cry into their cup of tea about how tough it is to be a Starz kid when our sons and daughters are overseas giving their lives for our country. I just don't have any patience for that. And I chose not to be that and not to take that path. And I chose, as he did, to fight against those things: career, second marriages, being the son of the first marriage, the press, all those different things that slowly pushed us apart, and that we both made a conscious effort and a conscious decision as our lives progressed to fight against in order to come back together, the best of friends against all odds in the end. That's the bowels of this story. That's the guts of this story. It's an enormously unique yet universal, enormously universal story about a father and a son, because this happens everywhere. As I say in the book, I don't say it in the show because it's told in my father's voice. The father-son relationship is unique, is enigmatic, to say the least. It's loving yet competitive, caring yet judgmental. And it is. That's what a father-son relationship is. And that makes for some pretty interesting stuff and pretty interesting storytelling. So that's where it all starts.
It's beautiful. So the other thing that I know you have, and we have about 20 minutes, is your independent film. Would you like to tell us about that and what it's
As usual, you know, as independent filmmakers, you might as well take a hairdryer and throw it in your tub. I mean, it's a quicker way, you know, to get out of independent filmmaking. Independent filmmakers are artists who go out and raise money, and every once in a while they're lucky enough to be able to ply their art. It's one of the reasons also that I decided I really, you know, I just can't do this anymore. I had such a heartbreaker, a film that, that I wanted to do so badly. Joel Zwick was going to direct it. My dear friend Joel Zwick, who did the wonderful film, My Big Fat Greek Wedding. And and he really thought this film was it was called it's still around. I mean, it's a pretty timely film, so you know we can still do it. But it's called Publicity Stunt, and it was just a cute, adorable little romp, if I do say so myself. Three times we had funding in the bank, and all three times, for different reasons, the funding fell out. And it's just so typical of independent filmmaking. But we got a new one on the slate here. It's called Aaron's Light, and I think it's a lovely idea. I was approached to produce it by the creators. And instantly said yes as soon as I read the script. And so we're going through rewrites now and getting ready for submission for budget. Will we get the budget? I don't know. You know, but you keep on trying. And it's a lovely story about an autistic kid who goes to Yale, and through interaction with the stone carvings, who sort of come to life in a very believable way and help him through his journey with autism to become more comfortable with his place in society. And he was always a productive human being. And I just, that whole, there is autism in our family as well. Gina's sister has married a fellow who has an autistic child, severely autistic. And what she's been able to do with him is just miraculous. So the whole subject of autism is very important to me. I actually wrote and produced a little song for Autism Awareness Day. If you go on to on YouTube, you can find it. It's called Where There's Hope. So I was very excited about it when they brought it to me, and I said, yeah, I would love to. So supposedly, I take off now for Peoria, Illinois, my mom's old hometown, which is going to be a trip for the rest of the month to do the show. And then I get back in October, and I've set October aside because hopefully by then we'll have some seed money and pending budget, and we'll begin the rewrite process and then getting our line producer will put out our budget and all that stuff, you know, the stuff you have to do before you can start pre-production. And we're shooting for it. One of the other neat things about it is the entire film will be shot on the Yale campus. So we're shooting for a spring 2016 shoot on the Yale campus. It'll be the first time that's ever happened where the entirety of a film, an entire feature film, will be shot on the Yale campus, where my daughter is presently at the School of Drama getting her master's degree. So that'll be fun, too.
So you can catch up with your daughter the same time you're working.
Exactly, yeah.
That's cool.
So it's some small, life small coincidences.
Yeah,
I have three kids. I have three kids in college at the same time right now. So this show's got to be a hit.
It's okay, everybody. Go to the show. It's got
to
be a hit.
Go to the
three
show.
Kids through school.
Yeah, exactly.
You gave that's
well, we'll,
a really.
We'll be out in your neck. We'll be out in your neck of the woods pretty soon too. In January for the Del Coronado Film Festival.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Oh, man,
I've actually
really
never been.
Oh, it's going to be great. You have to come in and come see the show, too. I think I'm doing it twice. I believe last time I talked to Doug St. Dennis, who's running it. It's a girl named Doug. I love that. And she's great. And she's one of the biggies over there that's running it. She's bringing me in. I think I'm working on Saturday and Sunday. I'm doing two shows. And then I'll also be there for talk back and just chatting. And, you know, it's the Del Coronado. That's where they filmed Some Like It Hot. So
yep.
it's really a real coming home. And so I figured I'm going to bring all the kids too. I'm going to bring out a whole flock of lemons. So we'll all be out there, all five of us, hopefully five of us. Sid, boy, they work them hard at Yale, man. They don't mess around down there. She may have to go back to school, but Sid's my daughter. But my two boys will be there for sure. And Gina, of course. So we're really looking forward to the 15th through the 19th, I believe it is, at the Del Coronado, lovely Del Coronado Hotel.
Every time I go to the Del and I go by the patio, I can picture the scene in Some Like It Hot with all the old men on rocking chairs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, classic stuff. What a great film, man. I tell you, if anybody out there listening hasn't seen that film, do yourself a favor. It's so it's timely. It will, you know, I don't care how old you are or whatever. You'll love that film. It's just great. It's a great film.
Classic.
Yeah,
nothing
it is. The greatest
touches
comedy
it.
Of all time. Greatest comedy of all time.
Doesn't it have one of the most continuous laughs in one of the scenes?
I think in most of the scenes, actually, yeah.
Yeah,
I
but there's one scene.
I do the ending in the show. I play both Pop and Joey Brown. You know, nobody's perfect. It's one of my favorite moments.
Oh, I love that movie. I love that. Your dad is so funny in that film, doing the maracas, and he says that it's me. I'm getting married.
Yeah.
He's so funny. Yeah. Yep. Brilliant.
Da 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 da. Osgood proposed.
Classic. And another one of my favorites is The Great Race. And you do
that
a good impersonation of your dad.
Which one is the Prince of Potsdorf? Oh, you are a great.
Yes.
Well, if I don't, we're in trouble because I'm him for 90 minutes on stage. So I kind of have to do a good Jack Lemmon. And Professor Fates, push the button, Max. I do that. That's Blake Edwards' film, too. Just one of my very, very favorites. Wonderful memories from that. I actually ended up showing up on that set one day when Tony Curtis was filming the sword fight scene with Ross Martin. And he took me aside and taught me some fencing moves, you know, which was really cool. But my favorite memory from The Great Race was when I'd show up, Blake Edwards, you know, who was just wonderfully eccentric in all the good ways. He actually had golf carts because that's how they'd get around on the Columbia lot. It's such a big lot. He had golf carts mocked up to look like all of their cars from The Great Race.
So
my father had the Fatemobile golf cart, and Natalie Wood had her little Stanley Steamer golf cart, and the great Leslie had his golf cart that looked like the Leslie Mobile. And Blake, I think, had a Pink Panther, of course, as his golf cart. And
what
they'd
did
all,
Ross
you know,
have?
Ross
what
Martin,
did
I
Ross
don't
have?
Know. He wasn't there that day. I'll put it to you that way.
okay.
But they'd all race across the lot at lunchtime to the commissary in their golf carts, and played buggy bumper, I thought we lost you again. It's actually somebody trying to call me.
No, I'm still here. This time I'm still here.
That's all right. Good. was a wonderful memory from The Great Race.
That must have been so cute. They shook old movies of the old days in the different lots. They seem to have a lot more fun than they do today. I mean, with corporate structure, they can't do what they did. Like, they had races and they had picnics and they had big celebrations and stuff like that. I don't really see Sony allowing people to do that.
Well, it's how we started this whole interview. Here we are, just getting towards the end, and the same question comes up. Things change. It's that age of innocence that's slowly disappearing and being taken over by this age of mass communication. And the studios that when they were run by Louis B. Mayer and Samuel Goldwyn and these guys who may have been a bit tyrannical, but also had enormous foresight and the ability to almost create a family kind of situation on the movie sets where they were lacking as well. There were certainly some naughty stuff that went on too, but now it's all Coca-Cola, Sony, as you say. And, it's a lot of that age of innocence is gone, and it just is what it is. It's big business. And that affects everything about sugar, all the way down to the stars as well. I mean, listen, there's some really talented and charismatic. The golden age of Hollywood with those incredible stars, it's gone. And that's part of the romance of this show that I really wanted to bring back as well. I tell a story where I find Marilyn Monroe swimming in her swimming pool with John Kennedy, who was the then president of the United States. I mean, you're not going to find something like that happening these days. It's a true story. you know, it is what it is. It's and then he'd come out on the beach and play football with all the kids and stuff like that. I mean, it was just, you know, you're playing football with the president on Santa Monica Beach. That doesn't occur anymore. And that whole time is gone. Is there a right or a wrong or a bad or a good? No, there's no value judgment attached. It is what it is. But it makes for incredible memories and incredible storytelling. And that's, you know, that's one of the most exciting things as a writer and an actor, to be able to bring that to life on a stage, a bare stage with all there is me, a piano and a chair. And, you know, and there's pictures in the background and stuff like that, like slideshows, sort of picturey things going on that exemplify. But really, basically, it's me, a piano, and a chair, and a piano bench are the four characters in this play. And to be able to create that entire world out of thin air, you know, the art of illusion, that's what it is. That's what we do. The magic, you know, create magic. That's what you're supposed to be able to do. And to find that in this, and to bring that to people has been just absolutely thrilling for me.
I think that's the allure of acting, is that ability to create something out of nothing, whether it's theater, TV, radio, or whatever. I think that's why people get drawn to wanting to do it, is because they can see the magic in it. Even if it may not be up to par with some other magic, it's still magic. Anything that brings something from nothing is magic.
I think it is up to par with all forms of magic, and I think they're very similar. This entire decade-long journey started with a blank piece of paper. It all started with me holding a pen, it was actually a pen and paper when I first started, then it became a computer, but with me looking at a blank page and writing, you know, writing the first words. The father-son relationship is enigmatic, to say the least. And now here it is, 10 years later, this 90-minute show where on stage I create these characters. You see them in your mind, all the geography, the characters, the actors, the people. You know, I start with an empty stage, and at the end of 90 minutes, it's filled. I mean, there's just the entire stage is filled with places and people and things and events. And it's a fascinating process, and it's fascinating to see the audience's reaction to it as well, because they're right there helping me build it. This form of theater, more so than any other form I've ever experienced, at least, relies on that invisible bond that's created between the actor and the audience. That what we actors call listening, the ability to feel your audience and allow them to tell you where they want you to take them, and then to take them there. And it's never the same any two nights. This is a very strictly scripted piece of theater. It's not like I come out, hey, ladies and gentlemen, how you doing? Excuse me, sir, could you move your head shining in my eyes? It's not that. It's not cabaret. It's not any of that stuff. It's not some schmaltzy, you know, and then my father and I did this. This is a piece of theater. This is a strictly scripted 40-page monologue, literally down to the punctuation. I even have scripted when I swallow, because he talks so damn fast. I have to know when I can take a beat and literally swallow. Which I just did. But it's never the same show any two nights in a row, because the audiences are always different. And in listening to the audience and having them tell me where they want me to take them, and then doing that, the show becomes a very unique show every single time I do it, even though I'm saying the same words every night.
I'm going to have your information on my blog tomorrow, but can you give your website, because we're coming to the end, so they can find your information?
Well, before I do that, I'd just like to say you're a wonderful interviewer, Sherry. This has been a lovely, lovely 40 minutes with you, and thank you so much for having me on. And
you'd
like, yeah, absolutely. And you do your homework. How refreshing. You know all of these different films and all the different stuff going on. So good for you. You're very good at your job.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. My website is stonemanorproductions.com. Or you can just Google me and it'll come up. Remember, it's Lemon with two M's.
L-E-M-M-O-N.
Correct.
And Chris, C-H-R-I-S.
You got it.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for being on my show. I so appreciate it.
It was absolutely my pleasure. Anybody in the Peoria area who's happening to listen, I'll be there next week. So I'll be there for a couple of weeks. So come out and see the show.
Yeah.
We'll be at the Apollo Theater in Peoria.
Will you be coming to San Diego with the one-man show, too?
Oh, yeah. I was out there. We did Los Angeles. The show started up basically ostensibly in January, even though we were experimenting with it in different places before then. The real show started in Santa Monica. Then I was up in Ventura. Then I've been all over the place since then. We've been nonstop since January, which has been great. I don't have any dates in San Diego just yet, except for the Dell, and then the Santa Barbara Film Festival, and then the Solvang Film Festival after that. And they are all three right in a row, I believe, pretty much. So far that's all the California I've got are those three. But that'll change.
Okay. Just asking. Well, we've come to the end. I want to thank you very much for taking so much time to be with us and your patience during my loss of phone. I really live radio.
That's right, baby. The only way to go.
Walking on the tightrope. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, Sherry, thank you. You were lovely. Thank you so much for having me and letting me talk about this project so close to my heart.
Oh, I really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure. So everybody check out his website. And thank you very much for chatting with Sherry.